This is Audible.
Foreword by Max Cleland. When I first met my fellow Georgia resident Desmond T. Doss, the thing that impressed me was his humility, his courtesy, and his simplicity. I asked myself, how could such an unassuming and seemingly shy individual accomplish so much for his fellow soldiers? He sure doesn't look like Rambo or the kind of guy you picture getting the Medal of Honor. But when our eyes met and I looked directly into his gaze, I knew here was a man who possessed a determination forged of steel. When we talked, I learned that both of us were wounded in war due to an exploding grenade, his during World War II, mine during the Vietnam War. Desmond Doss was a combat medic who refused to carry a gun. He said, "While others are taking life, I will be saving life." One of the stories in this book describes a man whose life Desmond saved. This story caught my attention because the soldier had both his legs blown off. Another medic had left him to die, saying his condition was hopeless. But Desmond Doss said, "As long as there is life, there's hope." Desmond treated his wounds and carried him to safety. That soldier lived without his legs for the rest of his life, but he lived a good, long life. I can identify with that story. World War II was a watershed for America. Without the commitment, loyalty, and willing service of the greatest generation, our world would be a very different place. The lives you and I enjoy today might never have been. This book shares an unequaled example of one of the greatest from the greatest generation. If all Americans had the courage, loyalty, and unselfish attitude of this national hero, our country would be exactly what our founding fathers envisioned. Desmond T. Doss is an outstanding example of what it means to be an unwavering American and a dedicated Christian committed to living the biblical principles upon which this nation was founded. He demonstrated a keen passion for preserving our nation's freedom, to the point of being willing to sacrifice his own life for the good of others. Each time this combat medic ran into direct enemy fire to treat and carry another soldier to safety, he laid his own life on the line. And he did that time and time again. As this book reveals, in a single battle, he single-handedly rescued 75 lives. Those wounded but saved soldiers returned home because of one individual's decision and action, Desmond Doss. Those same soldiers had families and children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Where would all those hundreds of Americans be today if Desmond Doss had decided that the bloodied bodies scattered across the battlefields of Guam, Leyte, and Okinawa were not worth risking his life for? Those subsequent generations would never have been born. Those wounded American soldiers would instead have died and been buried on foreign soil. They would never have passed on their life force or fathered many Americans who live in this country today due to the heroic actions of one man who refused to carry a gun. Desmond Doss is not just an average hero, but a hero's hero. That's evidenced by the fact that repeatedly his fellow Medal of Honor recipients viewed him as their hero. The Medal of Honor was established during the Civil War under President Abraham Lincoln in 1862. 100 years later, there was an anniversary celebration at the White House. Those who held this nation's highest award and were living in 1962 chose Desmond Doss to represent them for this anniversary. On their behalf, he shook the hand of President John F. Kennedy. I'm certain that when Kennedy gazed into the eyes of this decorated veteran, he realized that here was an American who asked not what his country could do for him, but what he could do and did for his country. In addition to his well-deserved Medal of Honor, Desmond Doss received a Bronze Star for Valor with one oak leaf cluster, signifying 2 bronze stars, a Purple Heart with 2 oak leaf clusters, signifying 3 purple hearts, the Asiatic Pacific Campaign Medal with 3 bronze stars and a beachhead arrowhead, signifying he served in 4 combat campaigns, including an amphibious landing under combat conditions, the Good Conduct Medal, the American Defense Campaign, and the not-so-common Presidential Unit Citation, given to the 1st Battalion, 307th Infantry Regiment, 77th Infantry Division, for securing the Maida Escarpment. One of the treasures in my life has been that a little bit of Desmond Doss has rubbed off on me. I hope that readers of this book will have a bit of this Medal of Honor recipient rub off on them as well. May we all value and live up to the same ideals, morals, and commitment to freedom as Corporal Desmond T. Doss. Joseph Maxwell Max Cleland, former U.S. Senator, former Administrator of the Veterans Administration, July 2016. Prologue by Terry L. Benedict and Gabe Fadella. Military heroes are usually looked at as bold and fearless soldiers, charging into the field of battle to kill the enemy, performing extraordinary acts of bravery that bring them medals, public admiration, and fame. Private First Class Desmond Doss, an army medic in World War II, didn't exactly fit this vision of the classic hero. Rather, he was a shy kid from Virginia who couldn't stand guns and refused to kill anyone. What he experienced, however, and what we hope you, the reader, will experience, is the powerful story of a humble country boy whose blind faith, devotion to country, and love for his fellow soldiers took him on a journey of challenges. This was a journey that saw him tested in every way before being put to the ultimate test of putting his faith and life on the line in the most impossible of circumstances, the Battle for Okinawa. Desmond's determination to hold fast to his beliefs in the face of overwhelming odds won him the awe and respect of all who fought at his side, then the admiration and recognition of a grateful nation when he was presented with its highest honor, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Learn what truth and faith are all about as you read his story. Terry L. Benedict, Producer-Director, The Conscientious Objector. Desmond T. Doss, February 8, 1919 to March 23, 2006. Desmond Doss passed away quietly in his Piedmont, Alabama home on March 23, 2006. His life left us a legacy of faith that serves as an inspiration to all who knew and loved him. Desmond's funeral at the Southern Adventist University Church, located in Collegedale, Tennessee, was attended by several thousand people and covered by local news affiliates and CNN. Representatives from every branch of American military were in attendance, as were congressional dignitaries and the Pentagon. His finest tribute came as a troop of his beloved Pathfinder scouts in full uniform and colors marched into the church to Onward Christian Soldiers. Desmond's burial service was conducted at the Chattanooga National Cemetery with the highest honors awarded to a Congressional Medal of Honor recipient. A horse-drawn carriage carried his coffin, and a military honor guard representing all branches of the military stood at attention during the 21-gun salute and flyby by attack helicopters in missing man formation. It was a sight to behold, set against the backdrop of the outdoor arched burial plaza and the beautiful blue sky with patches of storm clouds. The setting was perfect for this gentle American hero. Prior to his death, it was Desmond's wish to see his life made into a film to inspire young people to hold fast to their moral and spiritual beliefs. His dream became a reality with the making of the award-winning documentary, The Conscientious Objector. It was our privilege to be part of this inspiring story that has been seen by hundreds of thousands in special town screenings across America and on national television aired on PAX, TBN, and most recently, the Pentagon Channel. The film garnered 19 Film Festival Awards from 2004 to 2005 and was submitted for Academy Award consideration in 2004. Our website has commentaries from various critics and individuals who have seen the film, who have been deeply moved by its spiritual message. If you wish to obtain a copy of the home video in DVD or VHS, please visit our website or call the toll-free order line at 1-800-447-9001. Gabe Fidella, Executive Producer, The Conscientious Objector. Chapter 1. The Loneliest Soldier. Time for the welcome sound of taps drew nearer, and a hubbub of noise and confusion filled the long wooden barracks as the men of Company D prepared to hit the sack. It had been an exhausting, exasperating day. The famous old World War I division, the 77th, had been reactivated to serve in another war, and training was just beginning. The division's insignia, the Statue of Liberty, indicated its headquarters, and the men assigned to it were typical of the melting pot of New York City. Many had been scooped up by the draft in the winter and spring of 1942, just after Pearl Harbor, and were older, tougher, and more cynical than the usual crop of draftees. Now, milling about the plain wooden barracks in various stages of undress, green fatigues, olive drab underwear, they were protesting loudly and obscenely in the harsh accent of the big city against everything and everybody. In the midst of the racket, a slender young man with wavy brown hair sat quietly on his neatly made brown blanketed bed. If the day had been a rough one for the older, tougher men, for him, it had been a nightmare. He had come into the army willingly, but as a conscientious objector, a non-combatant. Though eager to serve his country, he had the written assurance of the President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, through Executive Order No. 8606, and the Chief of Staff of the Army, that he would not have to bear arms. He had naturally assumed that he would be assigned to some phase of medical training. Now here he was in an infantry company. A little on the gawky side, with the flat drawl of the southern mountains, he neither looked nor sounded like the rest of the men in the barracks. Not just for solace, but as an integral and meaningful part of his daily life, the young soldier had turned to his Bible. As always, he found in it, in the Word of God, the feeling of comfort and peace. He closed the book and, in a natural motion developed over many years, slipped to his knees at the side of his bunk to say his prayers.
"Hey, look at the preacher!"
somebody shouted above the racket.
"He's praying!"
Howls of derision, hoots, and catcalls sounded through the barracks. The young soldier continued his prayers, motionless on his knees. The big city men, irritable and keyed up after a day of strain and tension in a new, demanding environment, were ready to relieve their emotions on any scapegoat. And now they had found one. A heavy army shoe sailed over a bunk and clunked on the floor beside the pious young rookie. It was a near miss. Another shoe came flying, and another, accompanied by more profane remarks. The man on his knees, though frightened and confused, remained where he was. He didn't want to get hit with a shoe, but he didn't want to cut his prayers short either. This was no time to offend the Lord. From outside came the sound of the first notes of taps. The sergeant in charge of the barracks stuck his head into the long room and hollered,
"Hey! You guys settle down in there!"
The lights went out. The barracks quieted down. The young soldier, his prayers finished, crawled beneath the covers. As the clear, mournful notes of taps faded in the spring night, he lay silently in the hard, narrow bunk, his eyes glistening with tears of loneliness and pain. So ended the first day of Private Desmond T. Dawes in the 77th Infantry Division. The days immediately following proved no better than the first. At night, in the barracks, the ridicule continued. Though he now waited for lights out before kneeling to say his prayers, still an occasional shoe hurtled through the darkness in his direction. What hurt more than anything else was hearing the third commandment being shattered all around him. The men learned that calling him Holy Jesus caused him great distress. One tough-voiced, hard-drinking man in his 30s named Carger, who seemed to hate everybody and everything, including religion, went out of his way to taunt Dawes in his harsh voice. All the names in this book are real, except for three, Carger, Steinman, and Costner. Mr. Dawes has asked that their real identity be concealed in order to avoid embarrassing them at this later date. Desmond would cringe. He had never in his life heard anyone take the name of the Lord in vain so brazenly. Carger apparently enjoyed taking his perpetual foul humor out on Desmond.
"When we go into combat, Dawes," he would say, "you're not coming back alive. I'm going to shoot you myself."
Then he'd laugh. By day, the non-combatant had another problem. Though assigned to the infantry, he would not accept a weapon. In vain did the supply sergeant, the platoon sergeant, the lieutenant commanding the platoon, and the captain commanding the company order him to take a gun. The slender private respectfully refused to do so. He was alternately threatened, shouted at, pleaded with, and coaxed. He appreciated the position of his superior officers, and he didn't want to cause anybody trouble. It was simply that he had received a prior order from a higher authority. Religion was to Desmond Dawes a direct and a personal thing. He had been raised in a Seventh-day Adventist home, had received his entire formal education in a one-room Seventh-day Adventist school, and had been active, fully, intensely, and exclusively, in a Seventh-day Adventist church. His mother, his teachers, and his church leaders had taught him that the Holy Bible is the Word of God, and Desmond had accepted their teachings completely. He did not consider the Ten Commandments as mere guides to conduct, to be followed when possible. To him, they were, rather, just what the Holy Bible declares them to be, the will of the Lord God Almighty. Desmond believed that they applied to him, Desmond Thomas Dawes, personally and directly. On the wall of the living room, back in the little frame house in Lynchburg, Virginia, hung a framed scroll depicting the Ten Commandments. Often, as a little boy, Desmond had pushed a chair over to the wall and climbed up on it in order to study the painting more closely. These periods of religious art study would take place only when his parents weren't home, incidentally. There was a family commandment which expressly forbade children to stand on living room chairs. Each commandment was illustrated by a drawing. The one that gripped Desmond most concerned the sixth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." It depicted the story of Cain and Abel. In the illustration, Abel lay on the ground bleeding, while over him stood the murderous Cain, dagger in hand. Little Desmond would stare at that picture in horror and fascination. How could a man be so evil as to slay his own brother? Desmond himself belonged to a warm, loving, happy family. His father, William Thomas Doss, was a carpenter who, during Desmond's childhood, provided a comfortable living for his wife and three children. Desmond, born in February 1919, was the middle child. His sister, Audrey, was 4 years older. His brother, Harold Edward, 2 years younger. One time, when Harold came down with a rare type of influenza that brought on a high fever, the rest of the family sat up all night with him. He was delirious and in such agony that at one point his mother fell to her knees beside his bed and prayed. As Desmond remembered it, she repeated the words from the Lord's Prayer, "Thy will be done," and then continued, "And if it be thy will, O Lord, to take Harold, please do it now. Please let him be laid to rest and not suffer any longer. But if it is not thy will to take him, please spare him this pain. We ask it in Jesus' name." Soon after that prayer, the fever broke, and Harold's pain and delirium subsided into a deep sleep. The next morning, the doctor was amazed at his recovery. Mrs. Doss told him how she had prayed. The doctor nodded with understanding. "Son," he told Harold, "the Lord has spared you." To young Desmond, brothers were to be prayed for. Standing on a chair in the living room, studying the illustration of Cain killing his brother, Desmond knew that he would obey the sixth commandment and all commandments as long as he lived. But though Desmond Doss never looked for trouble, he didn't like to be pushed around either. During grammar school years, some of the kids in the neighborhood used to tease him and pick on him. At first, he took it. Then, one day, on his way home from school, he found his way barred by a whole gang of boys. The leader stepped forward and gave him a shove.
"You're in for it now," the tough kid said.
Desmond felt the cold, heavy ball of fear in the pit of his stomach. He knew he was in for a beating, but he resolved to get as many as he could before he went down. Suddenly, he charged, swinging his fists wildly. The attack took the leader of the gang completely by surprise. He broke and ran. That was the end of the fight, and from then on, Desmond's peers treated him with respect. Baseball was the most popular sport in Lynchburg during Desmond's childhood. The kids began tossing balls back and forth on the first sunny day of early spring and continued playing all summer long. Desmond enjoyed playing as much as anyone else until the day, when he was 8 years old, he fell and cut his hand on a broken bottle. The jagged glass sliced through several tendons all across the palm of his hand. The family doctor looked at it, testing the dangling fingers, and shook his head sadly.
"You'll never be able to use this hand again, Desmond," he said.
Desmond's mother did not give up so easily. When the cut was healed, she began massaging his injured hand, moving his fingers. With her help and encouragement, he regained the use of his fingers. But the scar, which ran completely across the palm, remained sensitive. He could no longer participate in any sport requiring two good hands. At first, young Desmond was crushed. But as the days went on, he found there were other things a high-spirited youngster could do besides play games. Rather than sit and mope around the house, he did more than his share of the household chores. His mother loved flowers, and he would work with her by the hour, helping her and nature create beauty. They had so many flowers that they began sharing them with others less fortunate. At first, they gave flowers to their neighbors, especially when someone happened to be sick. People were so appreciative that Desmond also began taking flowers to the hospital and even to the city jail. Sharing beauty, he discovered, was even better than raising it. The visits were not always pleasant. One patient, an indigent, aged man with no friends or relatives left in the world, was dying with an incurable disease. He could not afford a nurse, and Desmond volunteered to stay with him. The pain the poor old man suffered was so intense that Desmond could almost feel the hurt himself. He couldn't stand it and ran out to get the doctor.
"Please give him something for the pain,"
the boy pleaded. The doctor patted him on the shoulder.
"I've already given him a massive dose," he said. "I can't give him any more."
That night, death spared the patient further misery. Desmond went home, but he could not sleep. He could still hear those cries and groans of pain. However, the boy did not regret having been at the old man's bedside. He had done what he could. The patient had not died alone and friendless. The boy had learned that even in such an unhappy situation, there can be a positive feeling of satisfaction from having done the best he could to help a fellow human being. This was in itself a reward. But sometimes more positive good resulted. One Sabbath, church services were interrupted for an announcement that a woman, a former member, was in desperate need of a blood transfusion. Desmond, along with several members of the congregation, hurried to the hospital. No one mentioned the fact that neither the woman nor her husband attended the church. They were Adventists. But there had been some misunderstanding when they moved to Lynchburg some time before. They thought they were not welcome at the church, and then it became a matter of pride to stay away. It was Desmond's blood, and his only, which matched that of the ill woman. He was only a skinny boy in his early teens, but the patient's condition was critical, and he offered his blood without hesitation. After giving it, he got off the table on which he had been lying and had to grab a hat rack to keep from falling to the floor. The woman pulled through. She and her husband asked Desmond to come see them. They offered first to pay him, then, when he refused, asked if they could not give him some kind of present.
"Yes, you can give me a present," the boy said. "Come to church."
They did, and became active, dedicated members of the congregation. With this background, Desmond Doss was poured into the mold of the model medical soldier of the United States Army. The higher echelons of the military establishment in Washington were fully aware of the existence of men like Doss, and had established an official policy to use them. A quarter of a century before, in World War I, bona fide conscientious objectors had been mistreated and imprisoned. Men were kicked, beaten, and dunked headfirst into latrines. During the war, 162 members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church alone were court-martialed because of their religious convictions, and when the war ended, 35 of these men were serving terms from 5 to 20 years at hard labor. Thanks to tireless efforts on the part of religious leaders and to the American tradition of religious freedom, all of these men were given full pardons on Armistice Day, 1918. In the period between wars, interest increased in the question of how the young Adventist could serve his country, as he is specifically adjured to do in Romans 13:1, and yet obey the Sixth Commandment. An elaborate program developed in which the church and the armed service cooperated to enable Adventists to serve where they were best suited, in the medical department. In 1934, the Adventists organized a medical cadet corps to train their youth of pre-service age in the fundamentals of military medical service. Several Adventist colleges and academies in the United States and other countries set up MCC units. The accent was on service to the nation within the framework of religious belief. In recognition of the valuable service which can be rendered by young men eager to serve their country, but without taking human life, the Congress of the United States specifically wrote into the military draft law the provision that the conscientious objectors be assigned to the medical department. Desmond Doss was fully aware of the situation. He was registered for the draft along with the other men of Lynchburg, and was classified IAO. The O stood for conscientious objector, and Desmond put in a mild protest to his draft board about it.
"I'm not a conscientious objector," he said. "I'm willing to serve. What I am is a non-combatant."
"There isn't any such classification," he was told. "You're in IAO, and that's where you're going to stay."
According to the official procedure worked out by the church and the armed services, Adventists would not volunteer for service, but would wait their turn in the draft. While waiting, Desmond had worked in a shipyard, a vital war industry, and had taken a course in first aid to prepare himself for service when the call came. When it did come, a shipyard official suggested to him that he could seek deferment on the grounds of being essential to industry. He refused to even consider it.
"I'm not essential here, and you know it," he said.
Many of Desmond's friends enlisted. Several were classified 4F, unfit for military service. There were those who took their own lives out of disappointment and embarrassment of not being able to serve their country. Desmond was profoundly affected. Despite his mother's pleadings and his father's objections, Desmond, desperately wanting to do his patriotic duty, enlisted in the army and entered military service April 1, 1942, at Camp Lee, Virginia. Instead of being sent to basic training in the medical department, however, he found himself with the newly reactivated 77th Division at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. The men were to train as a unit. In the confusion of those early days, Desmond Doss, draft classification IAO, was stuck in a rifle company. There is a saying in the army, whenever anybody complains,
"Go tell it to the chaplain."
That is exactly what Doss did. The chaplain, Captain Carl Stanley, received him warmly and listened to his story. Captain Stanley had a close friend in the ministry of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and he was well acquainted with the customs and beliefs of this comparatively small but extremely active Protestant denomination. He knew that this soldier was a bona fide objector, and as such, entitled by law to be assigned to the medical department. Captain Stanley explained the situation at division headquarters. Desmond was placed in the medics where he belonged and began his training as a medical soldier. Military medicine is a kind of advanced first aid, applicable to the battlefield. Desmond learned the contents of his two large canvas first aid kits and the specific use of each item. There were the battle dressings of various sizes to be placed over open wounds. There were packages of sulfanilamide powder to be sprinkled over open wounds before the dressing was put in place. There were cigarettes of morphine to be injected to alleviate the pain. Desmond learned not only how to make the injection, but, of equal importance, when to use the drug and when not. In some types of wounds, morphine can be fatal. With the other rookie medics, he learned how to use whatever material was at hand, saplings, rifle stocks, to make splints for broken limbs. He learned how to give blood plasma on the battlefield, what to do for shock, when to administer water, and when to withhold it. It was like going to school again. Desmond remembered the little brown shingled school operated by the church back in Lynchburg. There was only one teacher for 8 grades, but each grade contained only a few children. The teacher would work with each class in turn. Desmond recalled how, when it was time for his group to recite, they would move up to the desks in the first row. That brought them closer not only to the teacher, but also to the warm, pot-bellied stove in the front of the room. On chilly days in the winter, every child looked forward to the recitation period. Who does not remember his first school teacher? Desmond could never forget Mrs. Nell Ketterman, who, after his mother, was the greatest inspiration of his life. When the boy had been too shy to recite in class, it was Mrs. Ketterman who encouraged him. When he had despaired of making legible figures, it was Mrs. Ketterman who stayed after school with him, urging him with warmth and love and understanding to guide his pencil over the paper again and again and again until what had resembled chicken scratches became numerals and letters, clear and unmistakable. One day, it was Desmond's turn to wash the blackboards and dust the chalk off the erasers. He had perfunctorily hit the erasers together a few times and put them down. That did not satisfy Mrs. Ketterman.
"If a job is worth doing, it's worth doing right," she told him.
It was the first time he heard that simple philosophy, but not the last. It became so embedded in his brain that forever after he could play it back like a phonograph record. "If a job is worth doing, it's worth doing right." Those words became a part of his life. Desmond had been unable to continue school after the 8th grade. The depression that came in with the 30s made it difficult for his father to obtain work, and Desmond had to pitch in to help support the family. He found a job in a lumber yard doing rough, heavy work for 10 cents an hour, 50 hours a week. Of that $5, he gave 50 cents to the church as his tithe and $3 to his mother. He spent 50 cents a week for carfare and with the remaining dollar bought all of his clothing and necessities. Though regular school was over for him, he continued to go to Sabbath school. On the wall of the Sabbath school room hung a large picture of the Sea of Galilee. Each pupil could place on it little boat-like stickers for being present and on time, knowing the lesson, and knowing the memory verse. For an additional incentive, if you could say all of the memory verses for an entire 3 months, you would get a Bible. For each quarter of perfect attendance, the award was a bookmark. When he was just a youngster, Desmond missed one session, and that wiped out his attendance record for the entire quarter. From then on, he never missed, nor did he ever fail to prepare his lesson. One day, the family visited relatives out of town and didn't get back until late at night. The next day was the Sabbath, and Desmond had not prepared his lesson. Though he was so tired and sleepy he could barely make out the words, he still stayed up and completed the assignment. In the morning, he dragged his weary body out of bed and to Sabbath school. He had worked too many hours preparing his lessons over the preceding part of the year, had unfailingly attended too many Sabbath school sessions to permit one lapse to cost him the benefits and the rewards of perfect attendance. He was protecting his investment of time and study. In this way, to Desmond Doss, conscientious attention to duty became a way of life. Sometimes, at Fort Jackson, in an afternoon class, on a hot day, following a morning of vigorous exercise and a heavy midday dinner, with an instructor droning away on how to purify water or how flies can carry disease, some of the men would start to nod. Not Desmond. He was there, he stayed awake, and he listened. It was his way of life. Would you not believe, then, that this earnest, attentive medical soldier would have earned the respect and admiration of his officers, if not his fellow recruits? Instead, he was considered an oddball, a headache, a troublemaker by his officers, even up to the headquarters of the regiment. Why were they down on him when he tried to be an exemplary soldier, a conscientious cooperator, rather than an objector, in everything his religion did not forbid? There were several strikes against him. Prejudice against conscientious objectors prevailed, and although Desmond hated to admit it, he could see why. There were three other conchies in the division, and Desmond had no use for any of them. He was eager to serve his country in a non-combatant capacity, but these three guys wanted no part of military life. Period. Their only dedication was to the avoidance of work, and one of them, whose teeth were black from snuff, was downright repulsive. One day they were no longer with the division, for which everyone was thankful. But in the meantime, Desmond suffered through association.
"You guys are all alike," one of his sergeants accused him. "You talk big about religious freedom, but when your country needs you to help protect that freedom, you chicken out."
"That's where you're wrong, Sergeant," Desmond said earnestly. "In my church, we're taught to obey government authority, just like the Bible says. You'll never find me failing to salute the flag or trying to get out of a detail. I love this country just as much as you do."
Sometimes when the infantry marched out to the rifle range to spend the day in marksmanship training, Desmond would go along. But, of course, he would not participate. The hot, hard-working riflemen down on the shooting line, blasting off round after round until their ears rang and their shoulders ached, saw their medic standing around doing nothing. And, naturally, they resented him. But the main reason for Desmond's unpopularity was his insistence on keeping the fourth commandment.
"Remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy," the Lord told Moses some 3,500 years ago,
and Desmond, as we have seen, heeded the word of God as he understood it. Those words applied to the human race in general, and to him, Desmond Doss, in particular. No one, neither the commander of the battalion, the regiment, or the division, nor the President of the United States, could make Desmond Doss disobey a commandment given him by God. The only exception to the fourth commandment was that put forward by the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Desmond's Bible had told him that Christ had healed the sick on the Sabbath. Desmond was also more than willing on the Sabbath to help sick people and, in combat, the wounded. But there in South Carolina, thousands of miles from the fighting front, the sick were taken to the hospital, and there were no wounded. Desmond could see no conceivable reason for disobeying the fourth commandment. What made life especially difficult there in the 77th Division was the fact that Desmond, as a Seventh-day Adventist, did not observe Sunday as the first day of the week, but Saturday as the seventh.
"6 days shalt thou labor, and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work."
Desmond had known these words by heart almost as long as he could remember. The 77th Division, of course, and the rest of the armed forces recognized Sunday both as a day of rest and a day of worship. Practically, all activities at Fort Jackson terminated Saturday afternoon and were not resumed until Monday morning. There was a chapel on the post with services for both Catholics and Protestants. Every large unit had its own chaplain who could hold services right there. Maneuvers were usually scheduled to terminate before Sunday, but if they did continue through the weekend, provision was made to hold Sunday services in the field. As a Seventh-day observer in a First-day Army, therefore, Desmond found himself doubly out of step. First, his religion forbade him to work from sundown Friday until sundown Saturday, which necessitated being officially excused from every operation during that period, every week. And second, Because there were no Christian services held on the post on Saturday, he had to secure a pass to go into town to attend services there. These services usually included a young people's meeting Friday night and regular church services Saturday morning. It quickly became evident that in the matter of the United States Army versus Private Desmond T. Doss over the issue of the Sabbath, one of the two must back down, and it would not be Desmond. His first altercation over this matter occurred on his second day in the Army. He was inducted on a Friday. Saturday morning, the sergeant ordered everybody to start scrubbing the barracks floor for Saturday inspection. Desmond refused to participate. He had come into the Army prepared to perform necessary duties on the Sabbath, as he believed Christ had done, but scrubbing the floor was not, in his mind, a necessary duty. A floor can be scrubbed any day in the week. It was certainly not going to be scrubbed the next day, Sunday. The sergeant called in the lieutenant. The lieutenant couldn't get anywhere with the stubborn Sabbath keeper either, and angrily told him to get out of the barracks. Doss stepped outside, but a major came along and ordered him back in. He spent his first Sabbath in the Army huddled in a corner of the barracks, while the other men, working, invented nasty remarks and passed them along to him gratis. It was the same thing all over again when he joined the 77th Division. On his first Friday, he consulted the chaplain about getting a pass to go into Columbia to church. The chaplain, Captain Stanley, pointed out that regulations prohibited giving any man a pass for any reason during his first 2 weeks in the camp. "I believe that God will work out a way for me to go to church," Private Doss told the chaplain. Captain Stanley sighed. He knew those Seventh-day Adventists.
"I'll see what I can do at Division Headquarters," he said.
That afternoon, the pass came through. By the next week, Desmond had been transferred from the rifle company to the medical battalion. He reported to the battalion CO, Major Fred Steinman, to ask for a pass to go to church on Saturday. The major's concern was with the training of a battalion. He gave Desmond his pass, but when he continued to come back week after week, the officer became annoyed.
"This is the last one," he warned one Friday. "Don't come back for any more."
Desmond knew the major meant it. He asked the people in church next day to pray for him, and on the following Friday he asked for another pass. The major blew up and told him to get out. Again, Desmond went to Captain Stanley. The chaplain took the matter up with Division Headquarters, and it was determined that the Adventist soldier would have his Saturdays off just as the other men had their Sundays. Desmond had won, except that in the Army, it is not wise for privates to win over majors. In actuality, Desmond was never better off than anybody else. In exchange for his Saturdays off, he pulled special duty on Sunday, all day Sunday, but none of the other men were around to see him that day and resented his Saturday freedom just the same.
"You get more passes than the general," they complained.
The reaction among the infantrymen was especially bitter. There were the differences in speech and habits, his idleness at the rifle range, and now this special privilege. News of the strange soldier spread throughout the regiment. One day, Desmond ran into Carger, that hard, cynical older man in Company D who had taken such a delight in tormenting him before.
"You think you're so holy, Doss?"
Carger told him, adding some expletives.
"Well, when we get into combat, I'm gonna shoot you down like a dog."
It's not easy to live with men who hate you, especially when your sole mission is learning to care for those very men. This was a lonely, frustrating period for Private Doss. At such a time, a man turns not to his mother, not to his minister, not to the chaplain. He tells his troubles to his girl. Desmond's girl was pretty, blonde, serious, and, like him, a devout Seventh-day Adventist. Her name was Dorothy Shute, and she was from Richmond, Virginia. She was one of seven children of a disabled veteran of World War I, and the family barely got by on his pension. Dorothy had determined to make something of her life. The first thing she must do, she realized, was get an education. That required money. When she was still in high school, she got a job as a call porter selling Adventist books. Desmond met her when she came through Lynchburg. He and his family extended a normal amount of Southern plus Adventist hospitality. They took her for a drive one Sabbath afternoon. That fall, Dorothy attended Washington Missionary College in Washington, D.C. She supported herself by working as a domestic in the house of a Washington family. Her work kept her from carrying a full scholastic schedule, but she didn't complain. She was on her way. Adventists form a close group, something like a large family, and it was perfectly natural for Desmond to keep hearing of this ambitious young woman who was determined to get an education. She was the kind of girl he would like to know better. Desmond had never had a sweetheart. He had gone around with groups of young Adventists, but had never become interested in one girl. He had made up his mind to save his love and his affection for the girl he would marry. He was 22 years old before he gathered up his courage and sought his first date. Before his induction, he was working in a shipyard in Newport News, Virginia, for $1 an hour. He had a second-hand car. He was rich. One Saturday morning, he drove the 200 miles to Washington, hoping to see Dorothy Shute. People were just beginning to enter Columbia Hall, the college chapel, for Sabbath services when he arrived. He looked for her, but didn't see her. Finally, services began, and he went on into the chapel and took a seat. There, right in front of him, sat Dorothy. He leaned forward and whispered, "Hello," but she shushed him without turning around. He had driven 200 miles for a shh. After the services, the congregation gathered in groups outside to talk. Dorothy was standing with a young married couple she knew. Desmond joined her just as they were inviting her to dinner. "She's having dinner with me," Desmond blurted. Dorothy shot him a quick look, but she did not correct him. They did have dinner together, and all that afternoon, and supper, too. Desmond was well known as one of the young lay leaders of the church. He and Dorothy had several interests in common, and a great many mutual friends, and the conversation never flagged. He had intended to go on back to Newport News that day, but he put that thought out of his mind. He had found her now. He stayed over and spent Sunday with her, too, until it was time for her to prepare for her lessons. For once, Desmond disapproved of conscientiousness. But Dorothy said she would be happy to see him again, and Desmond sang all the way back to Newport News. From then on, Desmond drove to Washington every other weekend. Several visits later, he and Dorothy double-dated with another Adventist couple. Desmond and Dorothy were in the back seat, and, driving through Rock Creek Park, he kissed her. He was lucky she didn't knock his head off, because she was furious. Her face turned a flaming red. She had never been kissed before. Like Desmond, she was saving her love and affection for the person she would marry. Desmond saw the look on her face. "I love you," he said quickly. It was the first time he had said those words. That made the kiss all right. For, Dorothy confessed, she loved him too. But he was in no position to propose. They had discussed wartime marriages and both opposed them. Desmond knew he would be called into service any day. When the notice came from the draft board, he made his last visit to Washington to see her. "Will you wait for me?" he asked.
"Yes, I will,"
she said. Those were the most wonderful words he had ever heard. They spent the rest of Desmond's last date with her as a civilian talking about the life they would lead after the war. It was amazing how similar their dreams were. Neither wanted a big house or riches. They would both be satisfied with the most humble home as long as it was a Christian home. They resolved to have family worship every morning and every night. They both wanted lots of children to love and to bring up in the Christian faith. They parted tearfully, but bravely. Both felt sure they were doing the right thing. As the lonely weeks at Fort Jackson went by, as Desmond found his misery increasing, the letters from Dorothy became more and more important. They encouraged him to keep going. Her love for him was the sole comfort in his friendless existence. He asked her to come to Columbia on a weekend, and she did, staying with an Adventist family he had met at church. They spent a warm and happy Sabbath together. This time, the leave-taking was not so easy. On the long 4th of July weekend, Desmond took the long bus ride to Richmond to surprise her. When he arrived, he learned that she had gone to Columbia to surprise him. They could continue to cross paths for days. So Desmond stayed put. Dorothy, meanwhile, had learned that he had gone to Richmond and caught the next train back. They still had 2 days together. Gradually, Dorothy and Desmond realized that they did not want to wait until after the war was over. Both discussed their problems with their ministers, and they were advised to do what they thought best. That was the answer they wanted, for what they thought best was to be together, as man and wife, every possible minute. Dorothy and her mother began arranging for a wedding at their church. But Desmond's commanding officers had no intention of letting this Seventh-day troublemaker go off and get married. No one would give him a definite answer to his request for a furlough. In desperation, Desmond went over the head of the battalion commander to the regimental adjutant. He was waiting there when in came the commander of the regiment, Colonel William H. Craig, the silver eagles of his rank gleaming. He was the highest-ranking officer Desmond had ever seen, and the most formidable.
"Is there anything I can do for you, soldier?"
the colonel asked. "If anybody can, you can," Desmond said, quickly adding, "Sir, I want to get married." The colonel listened to Desmond's story and apparently decided that he was sincere. He picked up the telephone and called the medical battalion.
"Why can't this man get married?"
the colonel demanded.
"When a man makes up his mind to get married, you might as well let him go."
Desmond was given his furlough. He and Dorothy were married in a quiet ceremony in Dorothy's church. She came back with him to Fort Jackson. Just knowing she was nearby made his military life easier to bear. Chapter 2. That Ye May Be Able to Bear It. Reveille sounded with a strident urgency one Tuesday morning in late summer.
"Come on!" roared the sergeants. "Get out of those sacks! Today's the day!"
"You don't have to rub it in, Sarge,"
one of the men in B Company groaned. They had known it was coming for days. Now it was here. The company was moving out right after Chow on its first long march. 25 miles, with full field pack and a rifle. The march would be completed in 8 hours. That meant an average of better than 3 miles an hour. This was the day that would separate the men from the boys.
"Hey, here's the preacher,"
one of the riflemen called out as Doss took his place with the second platoon.
"How come you didn't get a pass to go to church today?"
"Now, what's he got to worry about?" another man growled. "No rifle, no ammunition. He's got it made in the shade."
The silent medic grinned, but didn't bother to reply. The two canvas first aid kits he was carrying were almost as heavy as a rifle and twice as awkward, but he had a feeling he'd be needing the kits before the day was out. This was more than a physical test for Desmond. It was his first real operation with the men with whom he would go into combat. He was now officially designated as a company aid man, one of the three medical soldiers, or medics, assigned to an infantry company. For administrative purposes, he came under the direction of the medical battalion of the 307th Regiment. But it was the riflemen, the doughboys, the dog faces of the 2nd Platoon, Company B, 1st Battalion, 307th Infantry, 38 men and one officer, with whom he would go into combat. They would be his medical charge. He would be expected to go to them, even at the risk of his own neck if they needed him. They should share a close and mutual relationship, he and the men of the 2nd Platoon, but in those first days it was just the other way around. As had been the case with the 1st Company to which he was assigned, the men of Company B were mostly from New York. Nearly all were from the North. They were older and tougher and exuded profanity. They had never known anyone like the soft-voiced young Southerner with his ever-present Bible. They called him the Preacher. They teased him about being married and insisted on dragging Dorothy's name into their earthy remarks about sex. This offended him deeply. He loved Dorothy and knew her to be a Christian woman with high ideals. Their marriage was blessed by God. The two officers in B Company with whom Doss had contact were Captain Frank L. Vernon, the company commander, and Lieutenant Cecil L. Gornto, 2nd Platoon leader. Captain Vernon, a fair and square South Carolinian who gave all he had to the task at hand and expected his men to do likewise, had no time for spare wheels like Company 8 men. Lieutenant Gornto, an articulate Floridian, was too busy striving to get his platoon up to the high standards of the CO, Captain Vernon, to worry about one medic. The first sergeant called the company to attention and turned it over to Captain Vernon.
"All right, man,"
the captain said in his positive, determined voice.
"We've all been training for this for weeks. I expect every man to give it all he's got and finish this hike on his feet. Platoon leaders, take command of your platoons."
Lieutenant Gornto, at his place at the head of the 2nd Platoon, whipped his hand up to his helmet in a snappy salute. Captain Vernon sang out the orders, the platoon leaders echoing, and B Company swung out of the company area, counting cadence at the top of its collective voice. Even in the early morning, the summer sun shone hot in the South Carolina sky. The atmosphere was humid. By the time the company had crossed over the first of the rugged little sandy hills, their green cotton fatigues were splotched with sweat. The heat of the day was yet to come, and 24 miles still lay ahead of them. By midday, the sun beat down like a big broiler in the sky. Some of the men had already drunk a full canteen of water, and now they had no more. They staggered like zombies, their eyes pulled back in red, sweating faces. Suddenly, One of the men slumped to his knees and collapsed. Doss hurried to him. It was one of the older fellows, a man in his late 30s. His skin was clammy, his pulse barely perceptible. It was a clear-cut case of heat prostration. Desmond made him as comfortable as possible and turned him over to the ambulance that followed. Then he had to run to catch up with the company. Captain Vernon, as fresh and tough as he had been when he started, was furious with the soldier for dropping out, and with Doss for not managing somehow to keep him on his feet. At high noon, they took a lunch break, K rations. Desmond had hardly choked down a mouthful when a soldier, slumped under a small tree, called him. The man had his shoe off and was examining a large blister on his heel.
"Can you do anything for this?"
he asked. "I'll sure try," Desmond said. He pricked the blister with a sterile needle, painted it with methylate, and then covered it tightly with a gauze dressing. Before he had finished, another man called him. Another and another, all with the same ailment. While the men of Company B sprawled on their backs, Doss was busy fixing feet. For some severe cases, he fashioned a donut-shaped pad to relieve the pressure. It seemed they had been resting only a minute when the first sergeant blew his whistle.
"Fall in!" he shouted. "It's a long way back!"
Blisters and sore feet kept Desmond busy all the way back. He'd fix up a man as best he could, then run to catch up with his platoon. Some of the men he treated weren't even in his company, much less platoon, but they obviously needed help. In spite of all the running he had to do to catch up, his canvas bags flapping at his side, Desmond finished the march with the platoon. Lined up, waiting for dismissal, three men keeled over, out cold. Desmond went to their aid. When he had finished with them, all the other men in the platoon were in their bunks with their shoes off. Desmond did not get a chance even to sit down. He checked every man to see if there was anything he could do to help. That morning, some of the men had jeered at him, called him preacher, made derisive remarks. Now, while they lay back exhausted, the slender medic knelt by their bunks and treated their feet. There was no jeering at Desmond Doss in the barracks that night. He had proved himself. He was one of them now, a fully accepted member of Company B. As training continued, the three Company A men were drawn closer together. One was Clarence C. Glenn, Jr., a round-faced young man with a big smile which revealed a gold filling in his front tooth. The other aid man was James A. Doris, also a likable chap, but more serious. Both Glenn and Doris were married, and when Dorothy came to Columbia to be with Desmond, the three couples frequently visited with each other. Clarence Glenn was the first real live Catholic Desmond had ever known, and Desmond was the first Seventh-day Adventist, the first fundamentalist Glenn had ever been close to. Though some of their comments might have horrified a theologian, still they spent many happy hours discussing their beliefs.
"I just don't see why you make such a fuss about Saturday and Sunday," Glenn said. "Sure, I know what the commandment says, but if practically everyone goes to church on Sunday rather than Saturday, there must be some good reason for it."
"There is a reason, but it's not a good one," Desmond said. "It dates back to the 4th century and a fellow named Constantine. He was a Roman emperor and a Christian. But most of the Roman subjects those days were pagans, sun worshippers, who observed the sun's day, or Sunday, the first day of the week. Constantine got this great idea that he'd make Sunday a Christian holiday, too, and attract all these people. If he couldn't lick 'em, he'd join 'em."
"What happened to Saturday?" Glenn asked.
"Oh, he kept that, too," Desmond said.
"You mean he introduced the five-day week?"
Glenn said with a big grin, his gold tooth flashing.
"Yeah, I guess he did," Desmond agreed, but he didn't smile. He didn't like to make jokes about religion. "Anyhow, they observed both days for, centuries. Originally, Saturday was kind of solemn, and gradually people began observing Sunday more. Finally, the only people who kept the Sabbath were the Jews, just as they'd been doing all along."
"But look, Doss,"
Glenn objected. In the 77th Division, it was always Doss and Glenn. First names didn't exist.
"I just thought of something else. Isn't it hard for you guys to get jobs? I mean, suppose the boss wants you to work Saturday."
"It's a problem, all right. But we usually find that the Lord works these things out."
Desmond paused. How could he tell his friend of his own personal, subjective experience with Sabbath keeping? From the beginning, it was all tied in with the love and inspiration his mother had given him. Being cuddled in her lap, listening to her read and relate stories from the Bible, remained one of his fondest memories. Desmond's mother had been raised as an Adventist, but his father had not. He smoked and, on occasion, drank. He approved of his wife's religion and found much merit in it, but he put off joining the church himself. One time during the booming 20s, Tom Doss asked his employer, a building contractor, whether if he became a Seventh-day Adventist and would no longer work on Saturdays, he could keep his job. The boss said no, and that settled the issue for some time. The Depression came, and virtually no new construction was going on in Lynchburg. Tom Doss was lucky if he could find work any day. Mrs. Doss worked in a shoe factory, and the children brought home whatever change they could earn from odd jobs until they were old enough to go to work. Mrs. Doss and the three children continued to go to church on the Sabbath, and Mr. Doss joined them whenever he could. One Saturday, they attended a small church near Lynchburg where Elder Lester Coon was pastor. He was a fiery speaker who said what he believed, whether the congregation liked it or not. In his sermon that Sabbath was one sentence that struck home. He seemed to be looking directly at Tom Doss when he said,
"To me, any man who doesn't stand up for what he thinks is right is a plain old spaghetti back."
Desmond saw his father's back stiffen. For years he had supported his wife and children in their choice of religion. He obviously thought it was right, but he had not stood up for it himself. Tom Doss joined the church. He quit smoking and drinking, and he was almost immediately put to another test. There had been no work for him for weeks. On Wednesday, the boss came to him and asked him to do a small renovation job which would take about 2 days. He put in Thursday and Friday on the job, but still a few hours' work remained to be done. Doss told the boss frankly that he would not complete the work on the Sabbath. It must wait until Monday. He would not even come in Saturday to get his pay. Then he waited. As far as he knew, the boss might refuse to pay him for the work